Welcome back, everyone. This is part three of our study of medieval Jewish history. Those who are new, welcome. Excited to have you. And no prior classes or knowledge necessary. There's plenty of prior knowledge, but no prior classes necessary to join with us and follow with us. Hi, come on in. I should be grab a seat there. Jerry, you get the nice seat. And what we're going to be doing today is continuing our study of the period of the Gaonim. And last time we had left off, again, no background really required to continue to pick up at any point. But this week we're going to be picking up with the fourth of the Gaonic personalities that we're going to be looking at. We're sort of going in chronological order. We studied Rav Achai Gaon, we studied the Halachot Gedolot, we studied Rav Amram Gaon, his Sidur, which was one of the most formative Sidurim in the evolution of our liturgy. And we looked at each of those briefly, and today we're going to have the opportunity to examine in greater depth someone we started to outline a little bit about but really didn't get into, sort of the kishkas of him and his experience and his contribution to Jewish thought and to Jewish history, which is Rav Saadia Gaon. Of all the Gaonim, perhaps the most renowned, I think arguably, certainly has a reputation as one of the most brilliant, and as we've mentioned briefly and we'll elaborate this morning, certainly one of the stronger personalities in Jewish history and colorful as well. Rav Saadia Gaon lives from 882 to 942, so he passes away at approximately the age of 60, straddles the 9th, and then primarily most of his productivity is in the 10th century. So he's a little bit later on the Gaonic period. We sort of roughly frame this as around the year 700 to 1000, generally speaking, roughly speaking. So he's already moving a little bit toward the end of the Gaonic period, although not quite at the end. There's some time to go. And one of the interesting and important things to note about Rav Saadia Gaon is that he's born, A, to a non-rabbinic family, and B, he's born in Egypt. And that's going to be significant because we're primarily centered, we talk about the Gaonim and the classic yeshivot of Sura and Pumbedisa, which are remnants or continuations of the classical yeshivot from the time already of the Gemara. We're talking about, of course, a community that's centered in modern-day Iraq or Babylonia, and a continuation, ultimately, of that exilic community that goes all the way to the time, really toward the end of the first Beis HaMikdash. So we're going quite a ways back, and this is a community that is steeped in tremendous tradition, and even though it's true that in the early 7th century we have the rise of Islam, and we have really a whole new set of cultural circumstances that affect the Jews of this community, nevertheless, it's viewed as a community that's steeped in tremendous traditions long before the Islamic conquest, its own traditions, its own roots, and the fact that someone is an outsider coming in, that Saadia is not part of the rabbinic establishment, and the fact that he is not born into a Babylonian-based family, but rather born in Egypt and spends much of his younger years in Egypt, a little bit of time in Eretz Yisrael, studying and growing there, means that his position in the community as sort of an organic leader of the Gaonic or Babylonian Jewish community at that time already had, if it wasn't compromised already, there's some question marks that could be raised, and this is something that some of his interlocutors, some of his opponents they kept at the forefront of their mind. They never let him or frankly anyone else forget that he's from non-rabbinic stock and that he's not one of us and all of that, and this really was something that was used against him in a court of law and beyond throughout the course of his career. We don't know that much about his family circumstances, his earlier years, his family. There's really limited knowledge, like lots of other personalities from this time period. There just isn't that much other than what survived, and very often it was their literary contributions that survived, and then other stories about them, but sort of firsthand spade work kind of evidence that we could really go through with the fine-tooth comb to get all the details of their family background or their early years before these kinds of people were famous, really hard to come by. So we don't have a ton of information about his earlier years. We do know that he becomes really, we used the term last time, a Renaissance man, as someone who had broad knowledge, really, of all, pretty much all disciplines that were known in the Jewish Islamic world at the time. That's pretty much all that needs to be said. He has expertise in Chumash and Tanakh across the board, in rabbinic literature, in the Gemara, in Jewish philosophy, in Jewish history, you name it. He had a real sense of expertise. He was a halachic expert. He wrote on matters of halacha, and he was a posek as well. And then in the secular disciplines as well, general philosophy. history, astronomy and astrology, the sciences, mathematics. He wrote prolifically and clearly had expertise in just the full range of disciplines. And that was at a time before things like Wikipedia and such, when you could imagine that you could actually master some amount, some substantial percentage of knowledge or wisdom that was out there to be conquered, which to us is a laughable notion. I mean, now everything is a specialty, right? We spent some time in medical school at Einstein, not here in the Bronx, University's medical school. And there, first you have to decide that you're going into medicine. And even if you're going to medicine there, you can study it academically, or you can plan to practice. And once you've entered medical school, I'm going to become a doctor. So then I can choose to specialize for my residency. I'm going to finally choose. Now, you might just choose internal medicine. Internal medicine comprises probably about 50, I don't know, it's upwards of somewhere between like 30 and 40, upwards of 50% of the different options that are available. So even once I'm through residency, I'm still making a choice, and then I'm going to decide on a fellowship, and then after that I'm going to do something else, and then finally you find your little niche. And that's true not just of medical practice, right? The notion of specialty is really a metaphor for how knowledge works nowadays. We all know that that's true. We know that that comes with tremendous benefits, because if I go to the general internist, the family doctor, there are limitations in terms of their capacity and their ability to know the details of elbow joints or whatever it may be. And yet at the same time, there's a challenge in terms of holism and sort of seeing things whole, and the notion of a gestalt, and knowledge becomes sort of distinct from all the rest of the world of wisdom, and that doesn't lead to intellectually well-rounded personalities, and that comes with its own set of challenges. Rav Saadia Gaon lived at a time where it was possible for truly brilliant people to imagine that they could conquer huge swaths of knowledge of different disciplines and pull them together. But never mind. As an aside, also, that the sciences and philosophy at that time were really considered one and the same branch, because science was much more theoretical, conjectural, philosophically driven, because it was prior to the scientific revolution. You didn't have Francis Bacon and the notion of scientific method that was developed, and so we knew what we knew on the basis of observation, but a lot of everything else that was out there was really based on philosophy. So there was just a natural sort of connectedness between different disciplines. So Rav Saadia, really, I think it's fair to say, of all these personalities that we're looking at, is the broadest, and just really comes with that mastery of so many different disciplines in a way that really that struck his community, and he was able to write about it as well. He didn't just know it up here. He really was prolific and wrote brilliantly on the whole wide range. I should mention also, among Judaic disciplines in particular, is his mastery of grammar as well, which at that time was something that was extremely highly valued. Yeah.
So you were mentioning that they're philosophical in the way they approach medicine. So apparently, it was the Greeks who had originally said that it was okay to do autopsies and dissection, as opposed to the Islamists, who said, absolutely not, you cannot touch anybody. Mm-hmm. So they learned from opening up pigs and horses mm-hmm. what a human looked like. And it frustrated these Jewish doctors who realized that the Greeks had already done it, but they could not. So it took a long time for the Islamists to allow the Jewish doctors to practice that, because we were considered secondary citizens anyway, so mm-hmm. we were allowed sort of at the end to do that.
But halakhically, perhaps the autopsies were not actually mm-hmm. the Jewish
I'm talking about when they were alive. They do surgeries. Oh. They couldn't even do surgeries.
To do. Fascinating. Yeah, so a lot of limitations. That is very interesting. So that's sort of just in terms of his intellectual breadth. And what about his actual, central events of his life? So the first one takes place when in the year 921. Here we have some firm records. He's 39 years old, so he's already accomplished. He's fairly well known, but not a celebrity yet, for lack of a better term. But he's developing a reputation as just this brilliant and sometimes fierce halachist and scholar and philosopher, and he writes strongly about his opinions. But really, what happens is that after his studies in Egypt, and again a little bit in Eretz Israel, he makes his way to Sura, and he makes his way to Babylonia, and he settles in the community there, and he begins to establish himself as a rabbinic personality, as a leader in the community. 921 brings one of the great calendar controversies that Judaism has known. It's fascinating that there are so many sort of divisive, almost cataclysmic moments. This isn't cataclysmic, but it is. It's certainly divisive, and it's an important moment, and it's sort of a worldwide Jewish controversy. And so often these issues center around the calendar, which at first glance you might think that we have, you know, more interesting. You know, calendar can be really technical, and sometimes to some people disinteresting. And like it's very, you know, it's sort of esoteric. It's mathematical in that way. Not everyone gets so excited, you know, when you think about what stirs people emotions and you say calendar. It's not necessarily a top of the list for all of us. It creates anxieties this time of year, but that's a separate discussion. But interestingly, but I think it's intuitive when we think about it, the notion of calendar as something that unifies a community. When there is a rupture or when there is a debate as to what the calendar teaches and what day it is today or when our holidays fall out, so that obviously can have all sorts of really dramatic ramifications and lead to lots of tensions and to really important debates. And we've seen that not just in Jewish history, but in general history as well. The Gregorian calendar, we skipped, I forget offhand what year. Anyone remember offhand? We skip Pope, I think it's Pope Gregory, we skip 10 days. I want to say it was June 4th to June 15th, but it was a 4th to a 15th. But in, I think it's in the 16th century, we essentially, because of all sorts of nuances having to do, I think it had to do with the dating of Easter in the spring, roughly analogous to what we have in terms of Pesach falling out in the spring, and that's why we have our whole arrangement of the leap year. And there was a recognition at one point by the Pope that that it just wasn't working out, and so he just added, among other changes that he implemented to the calendar at the time, we skipped 10 days. So that can be a little bit unsettling to wake up, and this is something out of like a Kafka novel, something like. Right, and not only am I a worm, but I'm a worm 10 days later. This is just really the theater of the absurd. And so, but that you know, that was something that was ultimately accepted, but these things are not simple. In the Gemara as well, we have some really interesting and classic debates. Actually, something I'm going to be studying with my 9th, 10th grade boys in Gemara Shir this year, which is the debate that appears in the fourth chapter of Brachot between the various Tanoim, the various rabbis at that time, as to the exact date of Yom Kippur that particular year. And Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Gamliel are going at it. It's also Gemara Masechet Rosh Hashanah, a parallel story. What is the proper date of Yom Kippur? And two of the great scholars of the generation actually argued. And so can you imagine that one of the great rabbis of the generation walks outside on Yom Kippur according to his the opposing view, right, and walking outside with their money bag and holding things at a time when you're not allowed to carry if there's no Eruv and so on and so forth. And this is the stuff of really sensitive and difficult issues. And so you already have precedent for these controversies within the Gemara itself, surrounding the question of calendar. And this question erupts again at this time in 921. Now, what's interesting here is that you have Rav Sadia Gaon living in Babel, and you have his the opposing rabbinic personality, in this case, someone by the name of Rabbi Aaron ben Meir. And Rabbi Aaron ben Meir is living in Eretz Israel. And Aaron ben Meir essentially decides that he's going to push up the date of Rosh Hashanah by 2 days that particular year, 921. Now, I'm still having, I've tried to examine this, and I only have a partial understanding. I'm still not fully clear on what exactly it is that motivates Aaron ben Meir to make this change. And because the literature that survived is so polemical and is so sort of, everyone is not just sort of taking a step back and objectively or sort of as an unbiased reporter, we know that that's something that is an ideal that we still strive toward. We haven't quite gotten there. But in theory, this notion of this unbiased historian, as it were, that's not the records that we have. So there's a lot of polemical, sort of antagonistic writing about this whole situation. So it's kind of hard to pick apart exactly the details. But the bottom line is, for whatever reasons that are intrinsic to his Jewish calculations, Aaron ben Meir pushes up the date of Rosh Hashanah by 2 days, and he issues a psakdin, not only for his local community in Eretz Israel, but for the worldwide Jewish community, changing the date of Rosh Hashanah and thereby all of the different holidays, more or less for the rest of our history.
On what basis?
So again, I'm not 100% sure exactly what's motivating him. It had to do with, it wasn't about the Pesach issue. It had to do with something about how the Chagim are going to align and increase certain problems over the course of the long term. I still can't sort of tease out exactly what motivates him.
This is long after Hillel.
So it's basically a critique. It's an updating of, you know, or it's saying that that was something that worked, right? A tweak, you might call it. So it's a critique, right, to the calendar. And Saadia is not so excited about this particular recommendation. And he writes back and he says he thinks this is a terrible mistake. It's divisive. It's halakhically incorrect. And who do you think you are?
Right.
Because you've got your community. You've got your community in Eretz Yisrael, and you want to pass them. You want to pass them for them. So right, go right ahead. I have no problem. Right, do what you need to do. I think you're wrong, but at least you have jurisdiction there. But who do you think you are, paskening halachic conclusions for our community? We have our own Rashi Yeshiva. We have our own Geonin. These are the religious, scholarly leaders of our community. Who do you think you are that you're going to tell us what to do and how to live our holiday lives? I mean, what kind of ridiculousness is this? Now, of course, our Rebbe Meir is in a difficult spot because he really does think that we need to change the calendar. The last thing you want to do is to change the calendar for the Jews of Eretz Yisrael.
Right.
Not so. So you can make an argument for unity on the basis, actually here, of overstepping what would otherwise be your jurisdiction on the basis of the long-term health of the full Jewish community. I mean, our Rav Meir makes exactly that argument in some of these letters that we still have extant, or the records of this argument in him and Saadia, but. Of course, if you're of Saadia Gaon, so what do you respond to that? Right. What do you say? Say, I couldn't agree more that we all need to be on the same page, and that's why, right? Even your community shouldn't change the calendar, right? So you see, there isn't much middle room for compromise here, and this is all or nothing. Either all the Jewish people continue to observe Hashem on the same date as they always have, or they don't. Ultimately, essentially what happens is that more and more, at the beginning of this debate, there is sort of, it's sort of even-handed. Like, no one really has clearly the upper hand in the debate, and it's back and forth a little bit, but ultimately Rav Saadia Gaon gains support from the rabbinate and from just the local community leaders as well, locally in Babylonia. They begin to back him, and they paskin very forcefully for their own local communities, and they push back. And to make a long story short, Saadia wins. That's just another way to say it.
Eretz Yisrael
is a small, is a substantially right. smaller community, and there is, it's interesting. I mean, the question of which community has greater authority goes back for a very long period of time. And of course, during the writing of the Bavli versus the Yerushalmi, the writing of the Gemara, the two Gemaras that we have, there were also questions as to who had jurisdiction, who has authority, and sort of which community eclipses the other one. And there's some underlying, I think there were overall healthy relationships between the communities. There's a lot of back and forth and travel, but from time to time there were questions that arose as naturally would, and there were questions of jurisdiction, questions of who has greater authority. We assume in retrospect that the Babylonian Jewish community, which was larger and considered to have from not the Tannaitic period, not the period of the writing of the Mishnah, but after the year 200, 250, 300, that period of time, which takes us really into the writing of the Gemara, that from that point on, really there's a, sort of a decline in the intellectual firepower of the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael, which doesn't mean that there isn't lots of intellectual firepower, but they become eclipsed by the Babylonian community, and by this time already, it's well weighted toward the Babylonian side. So this establishes Rav Saadia as, really does establish his celebrity, and he's now renowned throughout the Jewish community. He's the champion of one position, and it also establishes...
What you just said, so that's the basis for why Rav Saadia is... He gains support and he is out.
He gains, yeah, so in other words, this really solidifies and builds his reputation as a rabbinic leader in the Jewish community at the time. He's got tons of people who have rallied to his support, tons of people who have upheld his brilliance by taking a firm stand and leading. He becomes the leader of the opposition, essentially, except at some point he's no longer in the opposition because he wins. And really, now he has a whole base of support. He's got a base of rabbinic support, he's got a base of lay support, which wasn't necessarily his intention. He called it as he saw it. He probably didn't. Appreciated the opportunity to then protect himself and to take his talents to the community, but he just was someone, he would always call it as he saw it. I mean, he was very consistent on this well before he was a public personality. He just wrote out very strongly and very firmly. You find this in others as well.
Assuming his arguments are...
Yeah, cogently, persuasively, with... he would have done just great in debate.
Right.
except if there was that component about letting letting the other side finish their argument before you start yours, then already. Hmm. He was very eager. He really was.
Is there any way to know how that impacted the community of Eretz Yisrael? In other words, did it also upset the people? Were the people rallying behind Aaron Ben Meir? Like, was this something they needed? Did it impact? Was the decision, a community impact for them as well? Like, did they feel like, oh, now we've been short-stiffed, or...
Yeah, it was interesting. I think that my vague impression is that at the beginning there was more rallying, and then sort of by the end they kind of felt like it wasn't worth it, and that they just stood to lose. In the end of the day, the Babylonian Jewish community just had stronger standing, was more influential, just was considered to be more prominent, and... If you had to decide among the two, in the end of the day, Eretz Yisrael community would not be determinative at this point. It might be sad, but I think there's truth to it. So my impression is that by the end, maybe underlying there were hard feelings. It's hard to know. It's so long. We can't get a real feel.
No, it's so interesting.
But we don't have records
are.
That they we don't have specific records that they continued to fight to the bitter end, and that it ended in some public standoff.
The root of the issue is.
It wasn't like particular to Eretz Yisrael. It wasn't like it was like this is something you have to do for Eretz Yisrael because of Eretz Yisrael. It was more that just there was a general debate about the calendar that had equal ramifications and relevance to the global Jewish community. But it wasn't a cause of the Israeli based community per se.
No, not so much Israeli, just.
I don't mean modern.
No, I know.
Right. 100%.
Geographical.
Right, exactly. 100%.
It was already set so many hundreds of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Why would it even become an issue? That's really the question. In other words, up until then, the dates were always set and no one had any...
I have to look back in terms of what exactly the issue was. Again, I looked through even some of the primary sources and it's hard to tease it out, so I'll look a little bit more carefully. It has to do definitely with the details of the Chagim. In terms of the exact particulars, I can circle back and we can
look
it up next week.
It would be interesting to know if the decision was based on that. Like you were talking about divisiveness and that if the decision was based on that, even if Aaron Ben Meir was alerted to something technical and he was worried technically about the calendar, but for the greater good of the cloud, the decision was that this would be a terrible decision for whatever reason. And that would be, I think, having that context, knowing if that was the way the decision went, because it was more concerned about that.
All right, so let's do some spade work. And Belina there next time, which is in 2 weeks, episode Shana next week. Let's see if we can circle back and add a little bit more in terms of the particulars. Okay, so that's the first one, 921. It takes us into 922. By the time we come to 928, so Sadia is now 46 years old, and he's renowned, and there's an opening in the position of Gaon of Sura. And that position already, we had mentioned in the past that within the Babylonian Jewish community, the respective centers of Sura and Pumpedisa as centers of rabbinic authority in the Jewish community waxed and waned, that there was some back and forth, some give and take between them in terms of which yeshiva was more prominent. Now, this was at a moment in time when the yeshiva of Sura had lost some of its prestige. The previous Gaonim were not considered to be first-rate Gaonim, first-rate rabbinic personalities, and Sura was really on the decline. Now, a very influential and equally strong personality who served as the political leader, local leader of the Jewish community at that time in Babylonia. We mentioned this is the position of the Resh Galuta, the exilarch, by the name of David ben Zakkai. David ben Zakkai who serves at this time as the exlark, as the Reish Galuta of the Jewish community, and it's the responsibility of the Reish Galuta to appoint the Gaon whenever there is an opening. So David Ben Zakkai says, well, we've got a yeshiva that's on the decline, and we've got a a superstar who's already, I forget, he's not just coming up, but he's not just coming down the pipeline, he's already in the major leagues. I mean, this is the real McCoy. And so he decides he wants to appoint Rav Saadia Gaon to become the Gaon of the Yeshiva of Surah, and then to become the rabbinic personalities for all the environs, for all the surrounding communities over there. The problem is that this is not such a simple matter, because of course, first of all, as much as Saadia is a well-respected personality, he has lots of likes. He's got lots of people who are think very highly of him. But he also has, at this point, lots of
detractors.
Lots of negatives. Everyone, You can't find anyone without an opinion about Rav Saadia Gaon. He was the lightning rod. He was the central personality in the entire community of Babylonia by his own choosing, by thrusting himself directly into the limelight. He was the one. We can think of perhaps political personalities who have this. They're either celebrities of the first order to some, or they are they're derided and they're intensely disliked, and you can't find anyone who doesn't have a very strong opinion about this personality. They're just too prominent, they've been too active, they've gotten their hands too dirty in all, and honestly in a bad way, but I mean just mean that they've gotten really involved and enmeshed in the major controversies and issues of their day, and that's exactly how Saadia Gaon is perceived in the Jewish community. And not only that, but he of course is a very strong personality, and the exilarch upon that, and that relationship is an absolutely essential one. If the religious and the political leadership of the Jewish community at that time cannot operate in a way that's really mutually respectful and really strengthen and buttress one another, so then we're in a very difficult situation as a community. Not only does Saadia have an extremely strong personality, but his the one who is about to appoint him, David Ben Zakkai, his reputation is one who has an equally strong personality. So what? Now, which of those two, and which of those two is going to back down? In fact, one of the rabbanim who's just under the position of Gaon in Surah, but he's already older, not a candidate. He's not a candidate for the position of Gaon in Surah. But Rav Nissen Naharwandi, you'll forgive my. I'm sure that's pronounced more accurately in the original Arabic. But it's considered one of the rabbanim in Surah. At that time, a very prominent personality, and he raises a question. He originally recommends against the appointment of Rav Saadia Gaon, if only because it's just a matter of time until the Reish Galuta and the Gaon, they butt heads, and it's just not going to end well. However, he says that if you, David Ben Zakkai, insist upon appointing Rav Saadia Gaon, he's clearly the outstanding scholar of our generation, I'll back him no matter what. David Ben Zakkai insists, he's a strong personality, he gets the idea in his head, he's not backing down, and indeed in 1928 he appoints Rav Saadia Gaon to be the Gaon of the Yeshiva of Surah, and for a couple of years this really does indeed restore the prestige of the Yeshiva. Rav Saadia Gaon is internationally renowned, he begins to write teshuvot and begins to publish, and his reputation precedes him as someone with tremendous brilliance and wisdom and justice, and he comes up with all sorts of creative solutions to very difficult scenarios, and really the prestige of the yeshiva is very much restored. And yet at the same time, as was predicted by the aged wise rabbi in Surah, indeed, it's just a matter of time, and not too much time, until the two begin to butt heads. And in particular, in the year, it's in the year 930, so it's just 2 short years later, Which is, it's a good 2 years. But it's remarkable, just to interject, in 2 years' time, what Rav Saadia Gaon did for the stature of the yeshiva. So that's another way to look at it. But there is a situation that arises. And part of the challenge is that it's not just important overall for the Reish Galuta and the Gaon to have a healthy working relationship, but it's important for them to actually, there's specific concrete decisions that need to be made jointly in one way or another. So one example is a Psak Din. If the Beis Din issued a Psak Din, so the mechanism that was in place that they would follow is that the exilarch, the Rishkaluta, would first sign off on whatever the Beit Din had decided about the matter, and then the both of the Geonim, sometimes the both, sometimes it's just one, would need to also sign their name. So there was an inheritance case. It was a question of Yerusha that was involving the family of the exilarch, so it got a little bit complicated. And indeed, David ben Zakkai signed off on a particular decision. And not only that, but the Gaon of Pumpedisa at the time, of the rival yeshiva, also signed off on this decision. And it came in front of Sadia Gaon, and he said, "I'm a man of truth, and I just don't agree." He absolutely refused to sign. So they sent messengers to him. They say, "Reconsider. Isn't your relationship with the exilarch absolutely essential?" And so on and so forth. The children of the Reish Galuta, the Vin Ben Zakkai's children, they came and they appealed to Saadia Gaon and said, "Please, we beg of you," and so on and so forth. And Saadia says, "No dice. Absolutely not." We might quote the pasuk in Chumash, "Lo taguru mipnei ish." Right? The responsibility of a dayan is not to look at anything other than the facts of the case, without regard to impact on his reputation, on his position, on his standing. That's his responsibility, and that's it. Now, of course, the other side would claim that Saadia just wanted to give a difficult time to the other side, and so a question of bias can be thrown in both directions. But be that as it may, Saadia holds his ground and absolutely refuses. So, of course, as these things unfortunately go, it went from bad to worse. The son of David ben Zakkai threatens Saadia with violence. He still refuses to change his mind. It went down historically, and both Rav Saadia and David ben Zakkai excommunicate one another. I mean, it's sad. It really is sad. They actually depose each other. I mean, it doesn't work. Of course, ultimately, actually, and then Rav Saadia Gaon actually appoints David ben Zakkai's brother. I'm talking about family complexities, Hassan, to that position. All within 2 years of Rav Saadia Gaon's appointment. And it's a sad ending. In the end of the day, it was the Reish Galuta who had jurisdiction. He was the one who could appoint. It was very nice that Rav Saadia Gaon decided to depose the Reish Galuta. But so far as I understand, he didn't have that was on his charismatic personality. That was what we call soft power, not hard power. He didn't really have that authority. But that's what he tried to do. In the end of the day, David ben Zakkai does put Saadia down. He's no longer serves as Gaon. He appoints someone else. Excuse me, in his place. And then yet, a number of years later, Rav Saadia is actually restored to the position for some time, and that's how it went. And it wasn't really, obviously, resolved in a positive way. And it's a little bit of a difficult and obviously sad scenario. Yeah.
So I'm just curious, you mentioned Palestinian Jewry and how it was give and take between them and the sort of arising and emergence and subsidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, at the same time, though, wasn't Spanish Jewry mm-hmm. emerging, and mm-hmm. weren't they becoming a major center for Torah learning mm-hmm. and scholarship?
Yeah.
So how does that play into mm-hmm. this interplay between the Palestinian and Babylonian Jews?
It's a fantastic question. Where we're going, so we've outlined also in previous weeks, is that we're going to start with the Sephardic Jewish community in terms of its prominence really starts, our story starts primarily in Babylonia, and then the shift to the center of North Africa, and then a continuous shift to Spain. It's still a little bit early for the prominence of the Jewish community of Spain, the Golden Age of Spain, which will come to a time of very positive, or relatively positive Jewish-Muslim relationships and a real flowering of poetry and philosophy at Southern Jewish community. That's usually marked as running from approximately 950 to 1150. Saadia passes away in 942. So we're still a little bit early, and the voice hasn't yet fully found its community hasn't fully found its voice. So I think they're not quite influential to that extent, but as we continue and as things go along, as we'll see, it's an increasingly influential community indeed. So I'm glad that you mentioned it. Now, there's a silver lining when a Gaon of the stature of Rasadia Gaon is deposed from his public responsibilities. What do you think that might be?
Someone else gets to come.
Okay, but I mean for him. For him, I mean.
I was right.
Huh? Okay, so this is not the first rabbi or thinker or whatever it may be in Jewish history who, on the one hand, goes through a difficult experience in community leadership, but when they're on the other side, right, they have all of a sudden they have lots of free time on their hands. And if you're a prolific author and you already have that celebrity like Rav Sadia Gaon, and you don't have to necessarily be concerned in terms of supporting your family, hopefully, although I don't know exactly how, it's not clear how he supports his family exactly after this point if he needed to or how all of that worked, but be that as it may, it's very clear that after 9:30 he is freed up to write, and to write widely. And this really becomes, again, this is sort of the irony, the silver lining of his having been deposed. I'm not sure if that, do we call that a deposition? I mean that somewhat tongue-in-cheek. As the son of a lawyer, as the son-in-law of a lawyer, right? Okay, so that was a lawyer joke for our class. After his deposition. But really he has the opportunity to begin to write and to begin to write very widely. And so I want to take the opportunity to outline some of his intellectual contributions and some of his literary output that have remained. In Halakha, it's not as well known, but he does have a commentary that's not really fully extant. We don't really have it in any meaningful kind of way, but we do know from historical records that he did write a commentary on the Gemara, and in order, specifically in order of the various sections of the Gemara, of Shas. Now that's very important, and we're going to be looking at that a little bit later on, and maybe touching on either today or next week at the very end, if today we get there, which is that there is clearly an evolution that begins around the time of Sa'adi Gaon and earlier as well, and continues throughout the period of the Rishonim in terms of different literary styles of writing on the Gemara. Mm-hmm. And one of the transitions that we find is really we have the rise of the prominence of running commentaries on the Gemara. And that becomes sort of the next step, because in the writing of the Gemara, that period, and then the Savoraic period, which is this murky period between around 500 to 700 of the Common Era, mostly prior to the rise of Islam, for the most part, although not entirely, but during this murky period, we have sort of the crystallizing of the Gemara, but not too many additional commentaries which have remained. And in North Africa, as we'll see, and also here in the Babylonian Jewish community, we have the earliest roots of running commentaries to the Gemara, where the Gemara begins to become a not just a commentary, as it were, or an expansion of Mishnah, but now really becomes a primary text in its own right, where instead of studying the Mishnah and adding to it in terms of commentary or halachot in the Gemara, as we have the modern-day Gemara, but now the Gemara itself, together with Mishnah, becomes the canonical text, and it itself spawns additional commentaries, which are written upon the Gemara. Now, at this point in history, very often they're written sort of picking up on the language of the Gemara and then expanding it. So I might write a commentary that sort of summarizes, we'll see this as we go along, summarizes the findings of the Gemara and then sort of adds a little bit. And then over the course of Sephardic Jewish history in particular, the Ashkenazic parallels as well, is what you have is slowly but surely the independence of these commentaries, so that they transition from running commentaries on the Gemara, where I sort of summarize the Gemara in shorter form and in my own words, and then add my additional comments, what's the halakha, what's the question that I might raise, how might I resolve that question, to ultimately what transitions into independent commentaries, where I'm really writing more off the page of the Gemara, even as it's organized around the structure of the Gemara.
Rashi
is in the Ashkenazic, right. The Ashkenazic parallel. Rashi from France, learns in Germany, is at the heart of the Ashkenazic Jewish community a little bit later than this.
But he already has something to go on, supposedly, right?
He's not drawing on Sephardic texts. Rashi's drawing on Ashkenazic texts from his teachers, who already began in parallel to some of these Sephardic texts to write a running commentary. A little bit different, because in the Sephardic community you have more of a focus, and this remains already 1,000 years later, you still have this, more of a focus on practical halakha. Whereas in the Ashkenazic Jewish community, Rashi has a running commentary. He'll sometimes tell you what the halacha is, but it's more an exposition of the meaning of the Gemara, sometimes with a question and an answer, a little bit in the style of Tosfot, but earlier and not nearly to that extent, but a little bit less of a focus on the practical halachic ruling. We'll see this in the Rif and others we get to relatively soon. But so it's a little bit different in Rashi, but there is that parallel in terms of a running commentary, albeit with some different nuances, a little bit of a different texture. So Sa'adah, we don't really have it now. There isn't much that remains, but we know that he wrote some sort of running commentary on the Gemara, which is part of this overall transition to seeing the Gemara as its own independent text, and that's one contribution. And we know that as a halachist, even though we don't have much that survived, we know that he was widely considered to be one of the premier, if not the premier halachist of his generation. He's much better known for some of his other contributions, if only because those have survived. And frankly, we have halachic works. We have plenty of halachic works to go around in Judaism. We have a good amount of Jewish philosophy, but you know, in some of the other areas in which he wrote, we don't necessarily have as many prominent works, and so he becomes best known for those.
So you're saying that he set down a lot of halachot on his own. His interpretation may have been different from the prior, but they didn't.
Wouldn't be surprised. And
so, but I thought we have a Masorah that says you may not do that. Right? Doesn't the Gemara tell us that you cannot set down your own halakha unless your Beit Din was larger and smarter?
Right. Fantastic. Yeah, that's so fantastic. The Gemara
always
wants
exactly, and probably richer, and maybe even richer. The point is that where does he come off among many other?
Right, it's far from the only one.
Halachis, but to do so.
Yeah, fantastic question. That definitely requires a wider conversation, but I'll just say, just even on the technical side of things, there's a distinction between a gzeira or a takana, a rabbinic edict, and a rabbinic interpretation. Right? So if the rabbis stand up in a particular generation and decree a particular law, in addition to the Gemara, it's not interpretive. We're not saying this is what Chumash says or this is what God had in mind, but this is rather a rabbinic extension or a what we call a siag, a fence, lest one come to violate or trample the literal law of the Torah, the original law of the Torah. So that's what the Gemara has in mind when it says that a later Beit Din is not permitted to supersede the ruling of the prior one. But if it's a matter of interpretation, that Gemara does not apply. And then there's a separate question about disagreeing about different phases in Jewish history and when I'm allowed to disagree on an interpretive level. I don't think Rav Saadia Gaon disagrees with the Amoraim.
The Takana, which may or may not have been superseded later on.
So one example would be, these are actually questions about Takanot that no longer have the original reason. But let's assume that even if the original reason no longer applies, that the Takana remains. Let's just take that for granted.
Which is greater than Yehoshua's takanot.
Which is what?
Is that what you're saying? Because Yehoshua set down his own takanot when he came in.
Right.
So they couldn't even supersede that.
That would be true. No, but for example, medications on Shabbos. Just a random example. So that is an interesting outlier because the original reason for the takana was lest one come to grind medications, and it's not nearly as common. It happens, but not nearly as common to grind medications in preparations for their usage nowadays. But for example, it's generally assumed among halachic authorities that takana remains in force, even though you could imagine rabbis nowadays could come along and can say, well, hold on one second. Right. After all, the original reason for the takana no longer applies, and we don't want to implement it. Can't we revisit that? So again, that's a complicated example for some other reasons, but it's a case in point when the majority view would be that even though we could theoretically make an argument to overturn the takana nowadays, nevertheless, because our batei din don't have people necessarily of the same stature and quantity. And influence and so on and so forth as some of those original batei din, so we're going to be tentative or we're not going to overrule it until whatever time, just the Sanhedrin or whatever it is.
Didn't Rabbi Yossi make a takana around then for monogamy? Wasn't it right in about 10th century?
Rabbeinu Gershom.
Oh, Gershom, I'm sorry.
Rabbeinu Gershom, yeah.
Wasn't it around that time?
It is around that time. It's just a drop later than Sa'adia Gaon, probably the second half of that century to the beginning of the 11th century. It is around this time, and we'll circle back to Rabbeinu Gershom. He's an Ashkenazi posek as well, so we'll circle back to him in the earlier Ashkenazic period. The plan is to go through the Sephardic sort of all the way through the exhaustion. And then we're going to... No,
I just want to give an example of a takana.
Takana.
Mm-hmm. That wasn't and universal.
No, it wasn't because the Sephardic community did not call by it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
that's why it's the
Or Chalitza versus Kiva. Okay. So I think that they're more interpretive. Is basically what I'm trying to say. So what are his other contributions? So perhaps most famous is his is what's known as his philosophical work, known as Sefer Emunot V'Hadeot. And it's essentially a book on Jewish faith and core principles of Jewish thought. And he devotes a lot of time in this work, which is originally written in what we call Judeo-Arabic. There was sort of a mixture between the lingua franca, Arabic, and sort of a Hebrew-Judaic content to it. And there are actually a handful of scholars around in the world now who study Gaonic works and who study Karaite works as well, who wrote and spoke in Judeo-Arabic around this time. So guy, I took a course in... I took a graduate course with someone named Menachem Ben Sasson, and he does a lot of work. He's has expertise in Judeo-Arabic, and it's very technical work, but you get some fantastic things out of it. It's just it's amazing that the literature is just absolutely fascinating from this time. And many of these contributions had to be translated from Judeo-Arabic, and so there are prominent scholars who work in this area.
Is that like Yiddish?
Right. It's like Yiddish. There was a Judeo-Persian, which now we're just starting to look at. Middle, it was like
that's what I thought. You know,
it's like a very specific dialect of. Of course, if anyone from a non-Sardic family would have said that, that would have been like, you had to say it, right? Okay. What? Okay. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's quotable, for sure. By the way, if those are familiar with the name Rav Kapach, which we discussed a little bit last year, Rav Kapach, who was an Arabic speaker from a young age, having grown up in Yemen, he translated many of the works of Judeo-Arabic, whether it's the Rambam Zohar Nebuchim, or he translates Sa'ad Yagon, and others, the Chovot HaLevavot, which is another classic of Jewish philosophy. And so he grew up with Arabic, and so was very familiar with him, and he created many of the translations to modern Hebrew as well. Emunot V'Hadeot has also been translated to English, although I believe it's a second-hand translation, by which I mean, I believe it was translated from the Judeo-Arabic to the Hebrew to the English. So it's already, when you get that distant, it's already not quite at the same flavor, even the original translation.
This particular sefer that you're talking about?
This particular sefer, yeah. But it is available in English. And essentially what he does is it's 10 chapters, 10 major chapter headings, and he tackles many of the basics in Jewish philosophy, and the topics that he tackles gives us some insight into the issues of that time in particular. So that, for example, he spends a lot of time on proofs of God, a lot of time on epistemology, how we know knowledge and how we know religious truths, and what's the balance between a basis in scripture and in the psukim themselves in Revelation on the one hand and rationality on the other hand. So he develops here a well-known distinction that's attributed to Sa'adia that precedes him, but he sharpened and made it famous between mitzvot shim'iyot and mitzvot sichliyot. I'll look it up here. Another fringe benefit of the office space. So mitzvot shim'iyot versus mitzvot sichliyot. Any guesses what the difference between those two might be? Lisa, what is it?
Well, I don't know. I think the mitzvot sichliyot is what you're going to do an Aseh V'Nishma for, and then what you're going to kind of understand and work through and really be able to kind of get to the bottom of and understand thoroughly versus
Chok and Nishma, right? Roughly. Exactly. Roughly that distinction. Mitzvah sichlit is a mitzvah that is based on rationality that I might have concluded on my own even if it had not been taught at Har Sinai. It's what we call, and Jerry calls, a mishpat. Mitzvot shim'iyot are mitzvot that we perform despite the fact that we don't necessarily understand exactly what Lisa said. We do it because of na'asa v'nishma. I think it's that what you said. It's something that we listen to because of revelation and not necessarily because of our own understanding. Both are equally binding, says Sa'adia, but there is this distinction, this dichotomy between these two classes of mitzvot, and this is something that he really grapples with. Which mitzvot are rational? Which mitzvot are sort of super rational or not necessarily obvious? And obviously there's a spectrum. There are things that might seem very difficult to understand even after the commands. There might be other things that we might not have necessarily concluded on our own, but now that there is a command, they kind of make sense. So there's obviously a whole spectrum here, but he does divide into two classes, and he spends a lot of time and energy working this through. How do we know something to be true? Let's say something seems to be stated in the Pasuk, but it contradicts scientific findings. It contradicts human logic. We think it contradicts human logic, but we're not certain. How do we understand creation of the world and all these kinds of things where there are questions about sort of the balance between rationality and revelation and scripture and so on and so forth? And he develops a whole sort of approach or system by which he really judges particular cases in terms of what we're going to use and what's the proper balance in terms of understanding truth. So these are questions that really interest him and engage his attention. A lot of discussion about a creation ex nihilo, what we call yesh me'ayim, the notion that God created the world from nothing. At that time, we have just the beginnings mentioned, the Golden Age of Spain. The Rambam, obviously, on the basis of his exposure to Islamic philosophers who were drawing from Aristotelian and other Greek sources, there's the beginnings of that. And at that time, there were three prominent views among religious and general philosophers. Aristotle maintained that the world, like God, is eternal. There was no moment of creation, and that the earth had existed forever. Plato disagreed. Plato maintained that there was something that was eternal, some speck of whatever primordial matter that was indeed eternal, like Aristotle, but God fashioned the entirety of the universe around that, or out of that. So there was an act of creation, but it was not ex nihilo. It was creation of the world out of some sort of eternal matter. So Sa'adia pushes back against both, but these become a lot of the frames for the discussions about creation time of the Rishonim, and Sa'adia argues in favor of creation yesh me'ayin, which is the traditional Jewish position that God created the world out of literally nothing, that there truly was a moment of creation against Aristotle, but not even in the Platonic sense of a moment of creation of something out of something else, yesh me'yesh, something out of something else, but rather it really is ex nihilo, it's really creation yesh me'ayin. You'll see that many of these interests and questions that Sa'adia is dealing with then engage the Rambam later on, and many other Jewish philosophers, medieval Islamic based Jewish philosophers at that time. And so those are some of the topics in his Emunot V'Dayot. Fascinatingly, chapters, I think it's 6 through 9, all deal with the end of days. It's got 4 out of 10, if I'm correctly, that deal with the question of what will the Messianic era look like, and when is it going to come, and can we predict when it's going to come? At this time throughout the Middle Ages, there were many Rishonim and others as well who predicted the day. They attempted to infer from Sukkim, mostly in Daniel. That was sort of the common go-to at the time, when Acharet Hayamim is going to come, and is it legitimate? Others say, you can't predict and you can't know. There was a sense of tumultuousness of sort of, at this time there isn't an apocalyptic sense at the time of Sa'adia going, but there are questions that are discussed. Mashiach and when Mashiach is going to come and who the Mashiach will be are really central parts of the discourse in ways that maybe for our part of the Jewish community are not as central. Perhaps for us, there's a lot of attention given to this. And what exactly is going to happen? Like, is it really going to come riding in on a white donkey? And is it going to be brim up or brim down? And all those important questions that have been debated throughout the generations. So he spends a lot of intellectual energy, discusses the notion that might be two messianic personalities, known as Mashiach ben David, but also Mashiach ben Yosef, and he discusses that at some length, and has some fantastical agadot that he draws from, which we don't really focus on, again, very often, certainly in the Ashkenazic world, on many of these accounts, these are things that he gives a lot of energy to. And then the 10th chapter, and this is also very medieval of him, I think it's a very beautiful section, is he talks about character and sort of his presentations in the 10th and final chapter of Yoseo. What does it mean to live the good life, essentially? What does that look like? Not just what do we do, but what kind of character do we cultivate? And what kind of people do we want to be? And that becomes a very extended conversation for him. Something he focuses a lot of energy on. And this, the question of the good life is not one that we always hear in modern thought, but it really was important to originally Aristotle, and it makes its way in a little bit of a different sense in the Middle Ages as well. A lot of thought about this, and he beat the Rambam. Not Aristotle, but he beats the Rambam to the golden mean. Mm-hmm. Everyone says that the Rambam, it's true, the Rambam adopts, but also, for those who were here on Sunday, Rabbi Pearl mentioned, right, he adapts some aspects of the golden mean, that's for sure true, and he explicitly is indebted to Aristotle for that, the Rambam, but Sa'adu beats him to the punch, and he discusses also the notion of a balanced lifestyle, and a sort of what are the extremes of our personality, and how do we want to fall in the middle, some really rich discussion about the character that we're trying to cultivate. And there's really this sense for Sadegon that it's not only about our performance of mitzvot in the technical sense. It's obviously critical for him. He thought about that regularly. It was obviously important to him, essential to him, but also sort of the inner character of the person. We find this in other thinkers as well. Later on, we have the Chovot Halvavot. Rav Bachya ibn Pekuda, also a little bit later, is an 11th to 12th century Sephardic thinker as well, but spends a lot of energy on chovot halvavot. What are we meant to believe? What are we meant to think? What's our inner experience supposed to be? And he also spends a lot of time and energy on proofs of God and epistemology, but also on character development and Jewish ethics. And not just in terms of technical halachic obligations, not, God forbid, to do away with those or to diminish their significance in any way, but to add to that and to say there's this whole other world as to who we are. And that needs to be part of the conversation. Chovot halvavot have their own quote-unquote halachic significance, as it were, in their own right. So those are some of the topics. Some of the sections are really seem a little bit obscure to us, especially the proofs of God stuff. You read this stuff, they spent a lot of time and energy on these things, and not just him, all of them. That's what everyone,
that we talked about.
Right, that was, that's what, if you went to a university course, if there were no modern, right? That occupied a lot of their time and energy, and Sa'adi is no exception. Sometimes these conversations about the complexity and the nuances, for the modern reader, it often does not resonate for many of us. It's like, well, if I accept this proposition and that proposition, it's like an incredibly complex geometric proof. It's lines of argument and intellectual acrobatics and back and forth. And the modern reader is much, generally, I'm simplifying, but largely is more interested in sort of the experiential dimensions of, and what does it do for me, and how does it inspire me, is it uplifted, where's the meaning in all of this? And it's kind of hard to find that when you're off in intellectual acrobatics and trying to figure out whether or not the teleological proof of God is indeed ironclad, and whether or not the third proposition is subject to the sixth critique in a compelling way. It just kind of doesn't have the same flavor to all of us. He writes on other areas as well. He writes on Chumash. He writes on Chumash twice. He has a translation into Arabic called the Tafsir. Which remains, and he also has a commentary. If you take a look, we have snippets of his commentary which have been translated again by Rav Kapach for the Torat Chaim. If you turn around and you look, I don't have it here at the table, but if you turn around at the white Torat Chaim set on the second shelf down on the right side, so on Breishit and Shemot, I think it is, we have commentaries of Sa'adu Gaon. They're short, they're pithy, they're to the point. Sometimes they're a little bit opaque, kind of hard to make out, because they are translated from the Arabic and they are kind of short and to the point. It's really interesting. And the fact that they've been translated by Rav Kapach and now are integrated into one of the classic sets of our Chumashim is fantastic and really a wonderful opportunity. So we have both his translation and snippets of his commentary as well.
just a really quick question, because it's so interesting what you just said, and I know we're moving on to the other writings, but I just want to be sure that I understand the last piece, because we moved from looking at the character piece. I'm just curious, because he has halachic works, did he talk about those, write about those separately, or was the interplay between the two in his works? Could you see where he would explain why that piece was important to what you were learning out halachically, or was it a different world? Now we're going to talk about midos, and now we're going to talk about...
It's a fantastic question, a really important one, not only for him, but for
just
so many others
now.
As well.
Today, right? Yes. In like an hour.
You
need to know.
You need to know.
No pressure.
I can answer for others. Rav Cook, the answer is yes. And many others' answer is yes. For Sandhya, we don't have enough of halachic writings to do a real meaningful analysis. It's just not that much out there. We know that he was a halachist, but it's just in other writings, which are not primarily or essentially halachic in nature, that it's come down to us. So unfortunately, I don't know if we have enough material to really make an informed judgment about it.
And he was focusing on it because that's what people were doing at the time, the same way we talk about people were talking about proof of God. It's like a regular, that's what, you know, there was, you know.
That's just a course of study, yeah, that's
and,
what he did.
And also character development. Like, that wasn't, so it wasn't a uniquely Jewish conversation to be talking about.
No.
I mean,
but
certainly
in,
we've,
in
taken
Jewish,
the up, you know, we've taken the golden
But in the Jewish
hour.
Community, I think this was a little bit unique and the other way around. In other words, I don't think it's true that in the medieval world there was a lot of discussion about the good life and whatever that means. I'm not sure that that was something commonly discussed by Jewish thinkers that we know of. There were, I mean, mentioned Raphael Ibn Bakudeh and others. It wasn't unheard of. It wouldn't be unheard of. But no, I think it is a good. I think it is a contribution. That's a little bit. That's it's significant.
Thank you.
Okay, he writes extensively as well on grammar, on piyutim, lots of other things. I'll wrap up in just a second. And I just want to mention really one final note, and then we'll wrap up for this week, is that he does also have, he has contributions in terms of slichot. This time of year, which is interesting, he wrote piyutim, he wrote beautiful liturgical works and some poetry as well. If you actually take a look at the slichot, I believe it's the primary introduction that we say, in many of your Slichot books, you'll see that it was actually authored by, or originally appears in the Siddur of Rav Sadia Gaon. So either he wrote it, or he was the one through whom it's come down. It's quite possible that he wrote it, but that's also an interesting contribution. There's another one that said, the first time you say Slichot, on each of these Slichot, there's one piyut that we say. And that, I believe, is found, the source is in Rav Amram Gaon Siddur, some 50, 75 years prior. And then the second one, the one that said the second and then subsequent times before we say the Yud Gimel Midrash Racham, Hashem Hashem Karachem Vechanan, at least in the Ashkenazic liturgy, might be the same. I don't remember offhand. It's the same. They're both starting. Makes sense. Those are all survived from Rav Sadia Gaon Siddur, and we believe, I think, they're generally attributed to him. So, beautiful poetry and things that have survived with us and remain part of what we say and what we do until today. So that's our treatment of Rav Sadia Gaon. Obviously, a broad personality, a brilliant personality, a colorful and strong-willed one. But because of that combination of characteristics, someone who in many ways has remained with us in throughout all of his various facets until today. That's today, Rav Sadia Gaon. Next time, we're going to wrap up the period of the Gaonim. We're going to look at Rav Shvira Gaon. I have this, we didn't get there today, but I have a translation here of his letter, a famous letter of his we'll be looking at a little bit. Rav Hai Gaon, and then we're going to see with these personalities, we'll move toward people like Rabbi Nuchanano and Alfasi, Rav Yitzhak Alfasi, the Rif, who appears, they both appear in our Gemara, they're actually printed there. These begin the transition that we started to mention from the Babylonian Jewish community to the North African Jewish community of Morocco, of Fez, as well as Tunisia, and then we'll slowly but surely begin to trace that toward the Spanish Jewish community. We'll then take a moment to look at some of the fissures within the Jewish community, in particular the Jewish Karaite, or the Rabbinic Karaite debate, which is extremely prominent throughout the earlier parts of Spanish medieval Jewish history. The Gaonim, Sadia Gaon gets involved in that. We'll have to circle back to that as well. And we'll look at some of that. And then we'll trace it all the way back up to Spain. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
We're off the